Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
This June, we're re-releasing our series on Shaikimia Pate. Her family has continued to hold a walk in her honor, most recently this May in 2023, and we're currently working with one of her family members to get their DNA uploaded to GEDmatch. Her parents' DNA, in classic profile form, is already on file with all major government databases, and the GBI continues to actively pursue her case. We'll be re-releasing several important announcements and updates through June and July, so please, be sure to listen and share Shaikimia's episodes. Her family is still waiting for answers. Thanks for listening to Shaikimia's story, and for supporting all the families and victims featured on our show. They do listen, and they see your kind comments and your donations to their billboard funds and when you share their posts. It means a lot. This is the second episode in a four-part series. Please listen to episode 1, September 4th, 1998, before listening to episode 2. This is The Fall Line.
I called the police, but nobody, he didn't come. And then when he did come, he said she had to be missing 24 hours before they'll go looking for her. So I had another friend, which his name is Felicia C. She called down there raising sand and going on. And he came back out, but he didn't do anything. He didn't even report it.
Saturday, September 5th, 1998. The night before, Shaikimia Shirez Pate had vanished. Her mother, Veronica, had searched their neighborhood. So had their family, like her sister LaSwanda, her aunt Regina, her cousins, their friends, their neighbors, everyone calling out her name into the dark, calling the Unadilla Police Department and calling them again. An officer eventually came by, but declined to take a report. So the neighbors kept phoning in, raising sin, as Veronica says, throughout the night. And the Dooley County Sheriff's Office, the area's other law enforcement agency? They had no idea this was happening. Their office didn't get a report. By the time investigator Randy Lamberth was told there was a missing child, it had been 14 hours since the last sighting of Shaikimia Pate. Though the officer from the Unadilla Police Department had not filed a missing persons report for the child, he had called DFACS on her mother. To understand how this happened, how it could have happened, you need to know a few things about law enforcement in 1998 Unadilla, how the system operated. The Unadilla Police Department was actually dissolved in 2008. Since that time, the City Council has contracted with the Dooley County Sheriff to provide law enforcement within the city limits. Meeting minutes published in the Macon Telegraph indicate that they first did so on four-year contracts. Those had to be negotiated and approved by the council. Since that time, it's been Sheriff Peavy and his staff who've answered 911 calls originating from Unadilla. But the system has not always been so simple. During our research, we came across a lawsuit filed by a former Unadilla Police Department officer who was part of the force after its 2002 expansion. That's when there were six officers, double the force of 1998 when Shaikimia went missing. In his suit, he claimed racial discrimination against himself, a white employee, in a force he described as favoring officers of color. That suit was summarily dismissed. What we learned reading through it, though, was that both the police department and the sheriff's department had their own dispatches. So 911 calls originating in Unadilla would go first to the Unadilla police. Only if officers were not available would the calls be forwarded to the sheriff's office. If a Unadilla resident wanted to speak to the sheriff, they would need to call the main landline, not 911. So if the Unadilla police took a call and did not alert the Dooley County sheriff, it could be hours or even days before the information was shared between the organizations. In this case, any 911 call made by Veronica or her friends and family would have gone to the Unadilla police. And as we told you at the top of the episode, an officer did eventually come out, but he advised Shakimia's family that they'd need to wait 24 hours to file a report. That advice meant that no paperwork existed, so it couldn't be shared. None of the calls would have possibly been noted by the sheriff. Legislation passed in the early 1990s did away with minimum waiting periods in the case of missing children. In 1998, lawmakers were already on their way to establishing Amber Alerts. The high-profile kidnapping and murders of several children between 1996 and 1998 had laid bare how ill-equipped we were to efficiently spread vital information. So, for a child missing in the late 1990s, all hands on deck had become accepted practice. So why didn't the Unadilla police officer file a missing persons report? He came out to Veronica's house at least once that evening. He would have seen the neighbors searching. In media reports, he's referred to as a young officer, an inexperienced officer, and certainly not one who'd dealt with any kind of disappearance. And that's fair enough. But the sheriff could have, should have been informed. That would have been the work of a moment. Because when Dooley County was informed, that's when everything finally swung into motion. Between 2000 and 2008, a series of Macon Telegraph articles highlighted various issues faced by and within the Unadilla Police Department. In that time, there were at least three that we've identified, different chiefs of police, plus interim chiefs to fill the gaps. Leonard Smith was chief during a 2001 series of rapes and assaults that terrified Unadilla. He was dismissed from his position that same year. The Macon Telegraph reported that the former chief was, quote, sentenced to 5 years in prison for claiming simultaneous work hours at both the Unadilla and Fort Valley Police Departments. The Telegraph continued, quote, allegations surfaced in April 2006 that Smith, then employed full-time at the Fort Valley Police Department and part-time as Unadilla's chief, was being paid to be on duty for both agencies during the same hours. Now, Smith later appealed this ruling, which was eventually overturned, but he still served several years. He was also indicted, along with a few other city officials, for improper use of city funds. And his replacement, Greg Hadaway, was also dismissed as chief. The Telegraph reported that, quote, Hadaway was fired for having a female guest at a hotel room rented by the city for emergency purposes in preparation of Hurricane Ivan. But, quote, Hadaway alleged that his firing was political and had more to do with tickets written by police officers to friends and family members of council members. Based on these few facts alone, it's fair to say that, for the police department, the early 2000s were a turbulent time. When reading about Unadilla crimes and Shakimia's disappearance, there's little direct mention of the Unadilla police. It's much more common to find quotes from Sheriff Van Peavy or his son Craig Peavy or Dooley County investigators or even local GBI agents. It is noted that Unadilla officers did participate in searches, along with officers from at least four surrounding counties, the GBI, FBI, Georgia Department of Natural Resources, and the State Patrol. But that's the extent of their coverage in her case. With the police department 11 years gone, no one can prove what was said or done or not done that Friday night. Only on Saturday morning between 10 and 11 a.m. does the official record begin. When investigator Randy Lamberth was alerted to the situation, the missing child, he headed directly to Veronica Pate's apartment. You might recall that she'd received a visit from DFACS that morning, and the agent had actually expressed surprise that there was no report. With Veronica at the time that Randy arrived were friends, family, neighbors, and a local preacher. According to Veronica, the pastor, Don Moore, had been placing telephone calls throughout the night, trying to pull strings and get authorities involved. Everyone there was exhausted and tense and terrified, tired of waiting. Veronica's sister Regina had finally gone back to her own house, where she actually called the sheriff's office directly.
He hadn't been informed of anything. He didn't know that a call had come in about an 8-year-old child. Those were his words to me. He said, because with an 8-year-old child, you don't wait 24 hours. You get on the ball then. He said, that applies to adult, he said. That doesn't apply to a child.
The search began in Veronica Pate's own home. Shikemia's father, Chris Foster, was incarcerated at the time of her disappearance, but every other immediate family member was questioned and then interviewed. Veronica remembers the first few hours of the investigation.
So they searched, like, everybody's house from where I live on up through town. And after that, then they came. They did me first, and then they did. I still never got a book bag back. I don't know where it is, but they did that. Then they fingerprinted all us and stuff to check our fingerprints, and then they put the little dye stuff in my house to see what has she been killed or anything in the house or whatever.
Investigators worked their way up the street. They moved through the duplexes, the mobile homes, and the small houses that were separated by thin strips of grass or empty green lots. Based on our various law enforcement and family interviews, it's apparent that houses in at least a 5 or 6 block radius were searched. And residents uniformly gave their permission. Maybe this is when neighbors Keith Caldwell and his partner Sharon had told police they'd given Shikemia a hot dog that Friday evening. An immediate point of focus was Roxy's Club, specifically the regulars, both customers and the participants in the drug trade who congregated outside. Veronica reports that some arrests were made that day, but not in relation to Shikemia's disappearance. The arrests were made for drugs.
But he was saying that the reason he arrested them because he knew that if anybody seen anything, it should have been some of them because, like he said, it always was going to be a drug dealer and a drug user. He said, you know, if you were getting with somebody, man or something, they saw that. But if with a child, they should have been seeing something. And he said he know that they saw something. They just ain't saying anything.
Shank and Roxy Cosby, who'd been working that night Shikemia vanished, didn't offer any official statements. It's unlikely they even saw anything as they'd been inside. But their club would remain a part of the investigation. Law enforcement used the space as a makeshift home base for the search. Investigator Randy Lamberth, who's been on the case since day one, described the club as a natural choice.
The Roxy Club, the parking lot right there is right on Crumpler Avenue. It also was located right in front of the apartment in which Shasha and her mom and sisters lived. So it was just a convenient location that we could park and stage. Also, the utilities of the Roxy Club was open to us and we'll be able to use that as well. And it was just a convenience, and I mean, being right there at the apartment, it was extra convenient.
We asked Investigator Lamberth to describe some of the measures that were taken during that initial search, which spanned Saturday, September 5th, and Sunday, September 6th.
Local citizens had already been started on Friday afternoon doing searches in the area around houses, yards, along with the local Unadilla fire and rescue personnel. They was doing this. On Saturday afternoon, we started doing aerial searches, extended the searches out. We included four-wheelers on any path that somebody could have walked or either driven a vehicle. We would ride and stand out so far from that, just looking and see what could be found. There's actually been numerous searches where we actually extended, because of Shasha was wanting to go to a local football game, which was located in Vienna, Georgia, which was about, I'd say, 12 miles south of Unadilla. Any path of travel, we actually done aerial searches of the roadways there, see if anything could be found. We extended our searches even further outside of town. We actually went to, we worked a 10-mile radius, basically, of Unadilla and the point of incident. Anything else there, I mean, the home searches of about 5 blocks of the incident location was also searched with consensual searches of the residents. People opened their houses, and, they allowed us to go in and search whatever they had there trying to find Shasha.
Did you use dogs at times?
At that time, the dogs on the Saturday wouldn't really beneficial because of so much foot traffic and everything, and they'd been tracking somebody else and not Shasha. Now, later on into the case, yes, we did. We highlighted certain areas that could be possibility where we brought in cadaver dogs. There was a couple of ponds that were searched, several other areas that were searched with the cadaver dogs. All of these produced negative.
The FBI and the GBI became involved very quickly. How did that come about?
Again, with me contacting our local GBI agent that lived here within the county on that Saturday morning, their office became involved. And with a missing child, there are certain requirements through the National Crime Information Center we know as NCIC, where a missing child has to be entered within that computer system almost immediately. This child was entered into NCIC, and in doing so, it alerts the FBI, actually alerts the National Center for the Missing and Exploited Children, in which notified the FBI of a missing child. Then they contacted the GBI, and they sent agents in and started assisting.
The GBI's early involvement meant that, as early as Sunday, September 6, its agents were quoted in local media and were bringing their resources to the case. Though several agents were actively involved, the family's primary contact and later their friend became Ben Collins. Veronica told us that Ben became very close to their family. So much so that when he was deployed in Afghanistan in the early 2000s, he still called Veronica to check in. Collins, now with the Georgia Department of Corrections, still cares very much about Shikimia's case. He spoke to us about the frantic pace of that initial investigation and the difficulty of tracking down witnesses.
Well, I mean, we went nonstop. The first month, I know we worked 16 to 18 hours a day continuously to try to find Shikimia and to run the leads down that we had at the time. There were a lot of good people that lived in that neighborhood, a lot of hardworking people, but it was a high crime area. There was a lot of street narcotic sales, and that was probably one of the biggest obstacles that we had to overcome during the initial part of the investigation. We would receive information about somebody being at a certain street corner at a certain time, and we would go back and discuss it with them, and they would say that they weren't there, and then come to find out they were there. They were just dealing narcotics, and they didn't want to tell us that they were dealing narcotics. And that was one of the most frustrating things that we had to overcome.
As Veronica and Investigator Lambert have said, community members had already been searching for Shikimia, and that only gained momentum over the weekend. Before the sheriff's investigators had even been informed, flyers had been printed and were being distributed. On Saturday afternoon, the school principal, Dr. Bobby West, arrived at the home. Schoolmates' parents began to spread the word, and eventually all of Unadilla heard about Shikimia's disappearance. It happened through word of mouth mostly, before Shikimia could even be featured in the local newspaper or on TV. Sandra Ferguson, Shikimia's former school counselor, has a very clear memory of the moment she heard that morning.
Well, you know, we're a very small community, and the morning after she was identified as missing, I had gone to a local store. And at the store, there was a lady who was a huge school and community advocate. And she approached me and told me that Shasha was missing. The lady, who is now deceased, and I agreed to meet with several other people in the community and from the school at the local bank, and we just started walking the town. I really think initially everyone was a little bit in shock. You know, this is Unadilla. People missing in Unadilla. And we've had children outside misplaced for a few hours. You know, they might have ridden the bus with a friend, tell the parent or whatever, and we would find them. But to go that length of time without actually knowing where someone was, or, you know, they had tracked down everywhere they knew to look, the parents and family and so forth. So I do think initially, you know, that the school faculty and staff we were all a little bit in shock, you know. You feel anxious, you kind of panicky until you can kind of locate a child, and then when the time kept going, it was unbelievable. You know, I think the emotions kind of then shifted once the time had passed a little bit, and there was more of a sense of urgency. People came from around in the area with ATVs and first responders, law enforcement. You know, they were more visible in the community and everything, you know. And I think the classmates were a little concerned, too, because, you know, not only for Shasha, but their own safety. Because, you know, you're on the street one minute in front of your house or not far from your house. It's a road where, and a location where people were out all the time, you know. And so it's like, how could someone go missing and someone not see something? So counselors and support staff from the district, you know, came to the elementary school to offer some support for the staff and for the students. But I do feel like the community as a whole was on edge. You know, a missing child here in Unadilla, what do we do? And people wanted to help, but I don't really know that they knew how to help because they didn't want to hinder, you know, law enforcement either. It was a little edgy there.
Based on archival copies of the Cordele Dispatch, the Hawkinsville Dispatch and News, and the Vienna Observer, Sandra was right. The community was on edge, frightened, wanting answers, keeping their children close. Shikimia's classmates thought the same thing might happen to them. Within 3 days, the Unadilla principal, Dr. West, had arranged for special counselors to visit the school and work with the students. Early newspaper coverage of her disappearance have a veneer of hopefulness. An article in the Dispatch describes a balloon release organized by the elementary students. They put slips of paper containing information about Shikimia inside the balloons, hoping to attract attention and tips. The balloons were Shikimia's favorite color, pink. That particular article, though, ends with a worrisome line, quote, "There are no leads in this case." Several other stories describe the pink ribbons classmates and teachers wore. The News Observer reported that 50 local businesses were also displaying the pink bows. Tony Britt of the Cordele Dispatch added that local churches raise money to support the search efforts. But every article has one thing in common. Each notes exactly how long she'd been missing at the time of publication. Counting the hours, the days, the weeks, it sent another quieter message about the likelihood of her survival.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 U.S.-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out Pear.com today to learn more. P-A-I-R.com.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Within days of Shikimia's disappearance, law enforcement involvement had expanded. Tony Britt of the Cordele Dispatch makes first mention of the FBI on September 11, 1998, 7 days after Shikimia disappeared. The News Observer reported that in the first month, over 100 interviews were conducted. FBI spokesman Steve McDermott is reported as saying, quote, we are working under the assumption that she's alive. McDermott also pointed out that Shikimia might have been taken over state lines and that people in those states should be aware. That awareness never reached other states, but hundreds of interviews were conducted. As we said, that first weekend, they were mostly focused on the family. This is standard in any missing persons case. Veronica, her children, and her closest relatives were questioned multiple times. There are a few exceptions, like her sister Regina, who told us she'd never actually been formally interviewed, but everyone who lived in that duplex spoke with authorities. Veronica's mother and brother were also interviewed. As search parties continued, spreading out as far as the edges of Montezuma, Vienna, Perry, Hawkinsville, Cordele, the family spent a lot of time with the GBI. Though the initial search efforts were based out of Roxy's club, formal questioning occurred at the command center, which at the time the Cordele Dispatch reported as off Highway 41. Back then, the new sheriff's office within the justice complex hadn't been built. That 1998 command center is long out of use. When we visited Dooley, the new center is where we met with Investigator Lamberth. That new complex sits a mile or so off Pinehurst-Hawkinsville Road. Right off the exit, there's an old gas station that had at some point been converted into a massage parlor. And just a bit further down, past a few fields, is that Dooley Justice Complex. The building is highly efficient, combining a courthouse, dispatch, and the sheriff's office into one tidy box. A poster of Shikimia is still prominently displayed in the lobby, just like it had been in the command center. Everyone there still calls her Shy Shy. A new location, but the same goal. In the following clip, Veronica describes her initial experience with the GBI at that original command center.
Then they started taking, you know, asking questions, and then I had to do like a lie detector test, so I took like three. Then my mama came, she took one, my brother took one, and my oldest daughter took one. My other kids couldn't take one because one was 12 and one was 15. They did three lie detector tests on me, and after I passed all three of the lie detector tests, that's when they offered it was $15,000.
After their initial investigation, local authorities felt assured that Veronica had no part in Shikimia's disappearance. That didn't stop some area journalists from speculating on her involvement, though, or critiquing her reaction. In particular, an article in the Cordele Dispatch offered a troubling observation. It was Tuesday, September 15th, and Shy Shy had been missing for 11 days. In it, the author is summarizing a TV news interview that featured Veronica, whom she describes as, quote, showing little emotion and at times smiling to the camera. Now, this is hardly the worst thing that was said about Veronica or her family, but it felt worse coming from the paper. It got bad enough that a friend, LaWanda Granville, contacted that journalist to defend Veronica. In direct response, the journalist ran another article, this time including support from Veronica's family and friends. In that article, LaWanda is quoted as saying, quote, I don't think it was appropriate to say Veronica was showing little emotion. Her doctor prescribed an antidepressant for her to make her feel better. At night, she cries so hard that she shakes. We sit up with her to watch her and keep her company, and she sits in a chair waiting for her daughter to come home. Another friend is also quoted in support of Veronica. It's in this article that, finally, it's explicitly stated that the family are not considered suspects. Veronica's own memories of that time, the weeks and first months after Shikimia's disappearance, are fraught and hazy and dark.
They gave me trazodone, they gave me a fistful, they gave me Valium, they gave me all the medicine, but the medicine still wasn't doing no good. It wasn't making me go to sleep. It wasn't taking the pain away. And one day I came to Walmart, and I walked in Walmart. I was so schizophrenic, I thought them folks finna kill me. I don't even know how I got home. I drove home, but I don't know how I got home. And then I was still waking up at night at 2:30 in the morning, sitting in a corner crying. Didn't know how I got there, when I got out of bed. I woke up like a zombie. Because I don't remember. The only thing I remember is sitting in the corner crying and my clock saying 2:30. I threw away my alarm clock. Because every night I woke up, it said 2:33. Same time for 2 years. For 2 years, I didn't even go outside.
Our first visit to Unadilla, Veronica, her sisters Regina and Rotunda, and her cousin Sue all talked with us about rumors and judgments. Specifically, they reflected on how media and community view the parents and families of missing and murdered children.
Talk about what they saw.
And see, my thing is, the very first officer was trying to play the blame game. Oh, she's not here because you did something to her. Or you tried to make myself like she was a bad mom. But, you know,
yeah.
It happens. We can't stop God from things happening. No matter how much we would have all of had our arms around her, if it was time for her to be removed from us, God was going to let that happen. I mean, of course, everybody might not look at it the way I look at it, because I look at everything goes in order of what God had planned.
Everybody can play the if, coulda, woulda, shoulda.
Right. And
I've always said if we were going to blame anybody, then the whole community was to blame. Because we all did it. We all let our kids win. So there's no one person that could be blamed. We all would have to be to blame because we all did it.
In those early weeks, the Shikimia Pate Task Force worked 7 days a week. Both the GBI's Ben Collins and the Sheriff Department's Randy Lamberth described 16-hour days. The pace couldn't be kept up indefinitely. Manpower was eventually scaled back. The Cordial Dispatch reported that the team was pared down to 6 full-time officers and agents. They continued to pursue leads and search through the rural counties surrounding Unadilla. And after that first month of her disappearance, most in law enforcement were fearing the worst. If Shikimia was nearby and alive, wouldn't she have been found? In order to understand what might have happened, officials needed to understand more about the person who took her and why. In 1998, criminal profiling, the kind that we're now conversant with through shows like Mindhunter, wasn't part of the public consciousness. Maybe that's why there isn't media mention of the suspect profile that was developed in Shikimia's case. Former GBI agent Ben Collins told us that several professionals worked on the profile, coming from out of state to review the case. That profile has never been released publicly. When we met with the GBI this summer, Assistant Special Agent in Charge Todd Crosby confirmed that the FDLE had indeed worked on a suspect profile. While the GBI prefers to keep the precise details confidential, we can say this much. Based on our discussion and on what is generally known about profiling, some broad characteristics that could be applicable would be the following. A suspect would most likely be male. That's based purely on who commits crimes against children, assuming that a family is not at fault. Though women are much more likely to kidnap babies, a non-familial abduction of a child or teenager is more likely to be perpetrated by a male. That suspect would also likely be Black. Though not always the case, kidnappings tend to be intra-racial, with predators choosing victims mostly or exclusively from their own race. Finally, it would be logical that the perpetrator was or is a local. That's because strangers to the neighborhood were quickly spotted by its close-knit residents. But also, as locals reported to us, because of the drug trade. Law enforcement told us that dealers kept a close watch on who came and who went. Only a resident, a regular on the street, might move about without notice. As weeks turned into months, it became more difficult for the family and law enforcement to hold the public's attention. Shikimia's step-grandmother, Wilhelmina Foster, paid to have a billboard erected along the highway. It advertised the reward and featured a picture of Shikimia. But she couldn't fund it for long. After that first month, Shikimia's name faded from local media coverage. And Veronica stayed up, night after night, hoping her baby might reappear. She sat facing the unlocked door, which she left open despite her own fear.
I didn't want her to have to knock on the door. I didn't want her to be able to walk in.
After Shikimia was entered into NCMEC's system, Veronica was regularly supplied with flyers to hang around town. That meant Shikimia's face, and eventually her age progression, would stare back at Veronica from store windows. Veronica's 3 other children helped her weather Shikimia's 9th birthday that October. At Christmas, Veronica didn't feel like celebrating. But she still put up a Christmas tree because it was Shikimia's favorite part of the holiday. She still puts up a tree to this day. Even with the ribbons, the flyers, the searches, which scaled back further by necessity until they could only follow active leads, there were no breaks in the case. Investigator Lamberth tells us that after a time, NCMEC arranged to have Shaikimia's missing poster shown on America's Most Wanted. And to our knowledge, that's the one moment her story would have reached a national audience.
At the end of the show of America's Most Wanted, they usually run a couple-minute clips of other missing children, in which we were notified that they would be running Shy Shy on these clips. And each one of these clips for each child is about 15 to 20 seconds or so, and they usually run a couple minutes right at the end of the show. So this is children that's not only local here to us, but also across the U.S. Now, whenever I say local to us, Shy Shy is our first missing child that basically that we can document in ever a case like this.
Yeah, so do you know if that sort of initiated any national tips coming in?
Yes, we did get tips from all over the U.S., basically how these were handled. If they were in Georgia, they was passed on to the Georgia Bureau Investigations, and they would send their agents from their local office out to investigate and would rule these in or out, or say, you know, whether there's a possibility or no possibility at all. Anything outside the state of Georgia, in which there were several, these tips was passed on to the FBI, where they would relay the information onto their local office, and from there it would be ruled in or out, in which all of these was all ruled out as negative results for us.
Those negative results have frustrated generations of law enforcement. Julie County's current sheriff, Craig Peavy, now sits in his father's chair. He holds the same elected office, overseeing the same county. In 1998, Craig was an investigator on his father's team. Perhaps more than anyone, he sensed how the dead ends in Shaikimia's case affected then-Sheriff Van Peavy.
I can tell you that, of course, you know, something like this, especially anything that involves a child, affects all of us. But my father was always one to, you know, any case of any kind left unsolved, just worried him anyway. You know, he wanted to solve it. He wanted to protect and serve like he committed himself to do when he ran, you know. And he's always been like that, even outside the office. But I could tell days that things bothered him during this whole process, you know, even, you know, right as it happened and we were out looking, we had teams on four-wheelers and on foot, and any tip, any lead that came in, you know, regardless of how it sounded, we, you know, we checked it out. And I watched him to the point where some days I just didn't bother about, you know, is anything wrong, what's going on. I knew where his mind was, you know, and he just, this was just something that all he wanted to do, it was just about like nothing else mattered, you know. He had to find this little girl. And he had us all the same mindset. Nobody was there because he told us to be there. Everybody was there because they wanted to be there. From FBI, you know, GBI, different agencies, DNR, State Patrol, you name it, outside agencies coming in. You know, any little lead, we all jumped in as a team, split up in groups, and we searched so many places, you know, and followed so many leads. But, you know, it just, every time we'd follow a lead and it'd come to a dead end, I could really see it just, you know, eating on my father.
Eventually, it was late summer, 1999. Everyone, Veronica, her family, the sheriff's office, the assigned GBI agents, were acutely aware that they were facing down a stark anniversary. There might be a few articles to mark the 365 days that had passed since they last saw Shaikimia, but there was no new information. No one coming forward to say they'd seen her at another house, in a car, turning a corner. And maybe no one had seen. But that wasn't likely. Though the media didn't reflect it, Unadilla residents had not forgotten their lost girl. Parents remained wary. They kept their children close. Regina, Veronica, and Rotunda told us that, at that time, everyone remained in a near constant state of hypervigilance.
Yeah, when it happened, everybody in that neighborhood was, was frantic. Your kids couldn't go nowhere without you and stuff. And that's how she was about her kids when that happened and stuff, she said she was going to her, and all day long she called him when she didn't see him and stuff. And that's how everybody in the community had got, because, that's unusual for something like that to happen. So everybody had to know where their kids were then.
That was worse on mine after that happened. You can't do this and you can't do that. This might happen or that may happen. Mm-hmm. And one of them said, you don't trust nobody. You don't trust anybody.
But it's likely that worry didn't extend much past the town's borders. After all, counties near Dooley like Twiggs, Pulaski, Sumter, Crisp had all remained quiet. That peace lasted until August of 1999. That year, August 15th fell on a Thursday. In Twigg County, it was hot, bright. The temperatures that month hovered around 90 degrees. A little girl named Teresa Dean lived in a mobile home park right at the Twiggs County line. Teresa, who was 11, spent that day as she spent most others, more outside than in. The Macon Telegraph reports that in the late afternoon, she ventured outside yet again. That time, she was going to see a neighbor's new puppies. Teresa was reportedly seen near some pine trees at the corner of a road. That was around 8 p.m., just about the time Shikimia Pate had been spotted a year before and an hour away. And just like Shikimia, Teresa didn't come home. Next time on The Fall Line, the cases of two other children in Middle Georgia, Teresa Dean and Tevin Hammonds. And more on the man who committed a series of assaults aimed at young girls, a man who lived just a few doors down from Shikimia. If you have any information regarding the whereabouts of Shikimia Pate, you may report them, even anonymously, to the GBI or the Dooley County Sheriff's Office. Call 1-800-597-TIPS or 229-645-0930. There is now a $20,000 reward in her case. If you have a case suggestion, please visit our website and use the submission form. You can find us at thefalllinepodcast.com, at Fall Line Podcast on Instagram and Twitter, and The Fall Line Podcast on Facebook. Special thanks to Angie Dodd for her generous support. Our research assistants are Haley Gray, Kim Fritz, and Brooke Floyd. Content advisors are Brandy Williams and Liv Fallon. Music is by RJR. Allison McCullum assisted with administrative duties, and a special thanks to our new producer, Maura Curry, who also engineered and mastered these episodes. Find our merch in the Exactly Right Pod Swag store. A portion of our proceeds are donated to support the work of the DNA Doe Project. Oh, and just a heads up, in 2 weeks, we'll discuss how social media techniques can be used to close cold cases. If you'd like to participate, then check out Billy Jensen's new book, Chase Darkness With Me, which comes out on August 13th. We'll discuss techniques detailed in the book that Jensen used to solve or help solve 10 murders and to find missing people. And we'll find out more about how the same techniques might be applied to Shikimia's case. We hope you'll join us then.